The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WISO. I'm Vic McCunis. Back in 1997, I had a writer come out to the station to do a live interview. He was on book tour, and it turns out this is the only interview I've ever had with Richard Russo. He's become quite a well-known author, and as I've been going through my Best of the Book Nook archive, I've been pulling out a lot of interviews with writers who are no longer with us. Well, I'm happy to say that Richard Russo is still around, he's still writing, still productive. At the time we talked to him back on July 24th, 1997, he was riding high. He had a hit book out and a book that had been turned into a film starring Paul Newman. And in this interview, he reminisced about working with Paul Newman during that film project. And we lost Paul Newman almost exactly 10 years ago. He died on September 26th, 2008. Here's the Best of the Book Nook with Richard Russo talking about his novel, Straight Man. Good afternoon, Miami Valley. Welcome to the Afternoon Excursions Book Nook. It's my pleasure to welcome to the program Richard Russo. His new book is Straight Man, and this is the final appearance on his book tour for this book, and we're honored to have him here at WISO. Welcome.
Thank you.
Richard, I think a lot of our listeners have probably seen the film Nobody's Fool. Did this film make a difference as far as your writing career?
Oh, it made a huge difference. Yeah, and most of it really good too. Whenever an author has a movie made from a book, it's going to have some sort of impact. It can be a very negative impact if it's a very bad movie. This was a very good movie, I think, and so there was it. Not only putting Paul Newman's face on the cover of your book will do things to spur sales, so that was wonderful. But really, what it did too was to send readers back to the early books. The Risk Pool, in particular, I think, benefited from that movie. So it not only got me lots of readers that I wouldn't have had for the novel that was made into a movie, but it also sent people back to Risk Pool and Mohawk, and provided a real base of readership, too, for a new hardback coming out. If you've got a lot of paperback readers from the last book, it's a little bit nicer pool out there for the new hardback, too.
This book, Straight Man, had me laughing, but it's sort of a bittersweet humor.
I think so. Yeah, there are dark eddies and undercurrents throughout this book, and that's the humor that I like most in other authors that I read, the kind of humor that's just not gag writing or just funny lines, but has as its basis the underlying stuff that informed Mark Twain's humor, that informed Dickens' humor, all of those folks. There's a real seriousness to those comic writers, and that's the only kind of comedy that interests me very much. Having said that, I like it to be just as absolutely fallen down funny as I can make it, as long as it's got that undercurrent of edge or sadness or pain or whatever humor we use humor for to deflect.
My guest is Richard Russo. His new book is Straight Man. Richard, you come from the world of academia, and this book takes place in those rarefied hallways, those ivory towers.
I don't think there's either ivy or ivory or anything very rarefied here in West Central Pennsylvania University where this particular novel is set, but go ahead.
You used to teach at Colby College.
Right.
I understand, among other places. I understand that they are taking this personally.
No, actually, most of my friends and colleagues at Colby are able to read this book from a distance and have a good time because I've set this in a very different sort of institution, but the sort of institution that I have taught at in the past. West Central Pennsylvania University does not exist in the sense that I made it up. In another sense, it exists everywhere. It's the kind of state institution that it's at the bottom of the academic food chain. Add West Central to the name of any university in the United States, and you know right where you are. It's the kind of institution that has budget problems even in good academic times and has severe budget problems in bad academic times. The faculty there and places like this seem to be overworked, underpaid, undervalued. In many cases, burnt out and wondering where in the world their lives, their academic lives, their careers have gone, and they've paid them out a nickel and a dime at a time in senseless department meetings, and that sort of thing doesn't make people bigger people; it makes them smaller people.
John Hassler was here recently.
Oh, was he? Was he? Well, he knows the turf too.
he also minds that rich mother load of academic absurdity. Why don't you give us the basic plot? I don't want to give away too much about the plot because it really moves around a lot.
Yeah. It's like all of my novels are. They're not exactly tightly reined in. There's a lot of episodic. It's my work is episodic by nature, I think, and very digressive. And this book is rambunctious. It does take place not just in the academy, but really all over the place. It's really the story of a fellow named Hank Devereaux. His father, William Henry Devereaux Sr., was a famous literary critic who has left his son and mother when the boy was 9 or 10 years old. And Hank has decided very early on that he has one goal in life, and that's to be a very different sort of man than his father. When the novel opens, he is about to turn 50, and he's begun to suspect, among other things, that he hasn't turned out quite so different from his father as he would have liked. He was a writer where his father was a scholar, but they're both English professors, and the main difference between his father and him is that his father's been successful. At least he's begun to fear that. As the novel opens, he is beginning to come a little bit unglued. He's always expected his wife, a wonderful woman, Lily, to keep him on track, but she has had to leave. She's got problems with her own father. She has to go off to Philadelphia to take care of her own father, and she leaves Hank with instructions not to end up in jail or in the hospital. But Hank suspects that his wife may be leaving him. He suspects that his daughter's marriage may be falling apart. He knows very well that his academic colleagues in the English department would love to lynch him. And he's trying to pass a stone, or so he believes. His father, he refers to as a certified stone former, and has had trouble passing stones all of his life. And Hank believes that he may be trying to pass one as well. So that's where we find him at the beginning of the novel, trying to deal with all of these things. Without his usual strategy, which is to leave all of this to Lily, his wife.
So we have the frequent stops to go to the restroom.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is that undercurrent with Hank where there's always that sexual overtone behind everything. Now, is this just a guy thing? Or do you really think that this is like a key underpinning of the way that we just look at things as people, because he's always looking at things, and then he'll go, "Oh, I used to have a thing for her," or you know, what if this could have happened? Mm-hmm. And I mean, he's even looking at people's daughters.
Yes. His one of his colleagues' daughters is a beautiful young woman that he has been flirting with for some time. I think Hank's dilemma in this regard is, if not unique, at least different from what we normally associate happening to men, shall we say, of a certain age, coming into their late 40s and early 50s, who are tempted by trophy wives and Mazda Miatas and whatever we think of as midlife male crises. I think it manifests itself in Hank in a kind of flirtatious sexual way, but I don't think it really has much to do with sex when you come right down to it. I think for Hank, he is flirtatious with Meg and several other women with whom he claims to be half in love, but his clearest sexual fantasies are not himself with other women, but his wife with other men. And he has other women. He has become at this point in his life a prey to very vivid sexual fantasies of his wife with various friends and colleagues. He doesn't begin to understand them. He has no idea why he's being assaulted by these sudden visions. And I think what it comes right down to for him, both in terms of his own flirtations with women and these sudden fantasies that he's having kind of on behalf of his wife, is that he's come to an age where he begins to suspect that there isn't much left in the way of consequence for him anymore. He's married the woman that he wanted to marry. He's more in love with her than he knows. He's built the house that he wanted to build. His daughters have grown up and are married. He has been promoted about as far as he can be promoted. He is a full professor albeit at a dubious institution of higher learning. Things have kind of worked out for him in a way. And he has begun to wonder if there's nothing left for him but to just play out the string. And the same thing for his wife. What if really there's nothing else for her? And all of the characters in this book, all of his colleagues, are all kind of coming to the same conclusion at this point in their lives, is that this is the only life that they've got. It's the only life that's going to be given to them. And have they wasted it? Is it time to shake things up? Is it time to do something that will have some sort of consequence, even if it's a bad consequence, even if you're going to lose the woman you love that you've spent your life with? What are you willing to do in order to kind of change the end of the story?
So he's kind of losing it. Not only is he having these mm-hmm. bizarre dreams, donkey basketball is a funny one. You have a thing that happens to him frequently, and I could never quite figure out if he was always standing around talking out loud and people would come up mm-hmm. behind him. And is mm-hmm. he speaking out loud or is he just thinking?
No, I think he is. I think he's having these what he calls ellipses, where he where his mind will begin to wander, and in addition to, you know, he'll be talking with somebody who is he's talking with one woman one time who's a smoker and trying to quit, and he's having a conversation with her and suddenly she's halfway through a cigarette that he's not aware of her having lit up, and he knows that part of a conversation is gone, and she's looking at him, and he knows that he's been talking to her, and this has become a frequent thing with him to be thinking a thought and then have somebody say, that's not a very nice thing to say. And he realizes suddenly that he has spoken out loud.
Well, I must say, you were piercing my funny bone on a frequent basis. The portrayal of these academics interacting uh-huh. with each other, right up to Dickey and the Chancellor and all
right,
these people,
right.
It was so painfully real in a way to see these people. Like his antagonistic colleague who mm-hmm. he hadn't sold the lot to so many years ago. And just the way these guys would talk to each other,
yeah.
his drunken colleague.
Uh-huh.
I can
uh-huh.
see, maybe you don't know people exactly like these, but this is an amalgam of lots of folks you've known over the years.
Sure, sure.
But it's not you.
Well, no. And especially, I mean, one of the nice things about being a writer in the Academy is that nobody ever elects you to anything. You're marginalized enough as it is. All of your colleagues are your professor colleagues are all academics, and no one would put a writer in charge of anything. So I've been able to kind of look at my friends and colleagues over a long period of time. What interests me most about academics is that they know an enormous amount about a relatively small area of expertise. When they become interesting is not when they're in control, as they are in their classrooms, for instance, and when they're talking about what they know to their students, and what they know well. When they become interesting is when they're not in control. And this was the part of the book that I love. It's fun to watch. It's not just academics. It's lawyers. It's doctors. It's any kind of professional person who's in control most of the time. When they get interesting is when they lose it, when they're out of control.
And no matter how intelligent they are, you get too many of them into a room, they have a hard time figuring out how to get out.
They sure do.
My guest is Richard Russo. Now in Nobody's Fool, Paul Newman plays, is it Sully?
Yeah, yeah.
This is a powerful performance that he puts on.
Yeah.
What was he like? Did you get to know him at all?
Well, I don't know Paul particularly well. I went down to where they were shooting the movie in Beacon and Poughkeepsie, New York, which is actually not too far from where Paul lives in Westport, Connecticut. I think that's why they chose it as a location, because it would be an easy commute for him on weekends. I went down to Beacon during the second or third week in the shoot because I'd been asked to do some script doctor work on Robert Benton's script, and met with Paul for an afternoon and then part of the following morning. And he was already incredibly intense. He was already walking. Sully's knee is shattered in the novel, and so he limps throughout this movie. And Paul was already limping everywhere. I mean, whether or not he was on the set, he was already well into this character, and there were times when I wasn't sure who I was talking to, and I was really talking with the man I was talking to. He was so completely in character so much of the time. I don't know whether I was learning things about Paul or the person that I had invented for him to play. But during that time, he was, all he wanted to talk about was Sully, anything I could tell him that might not have been in the novel. It was fascinating to watch him work. He wanted to know. He said, when Sully's driving along in that truck, what kind of music does he listen to? Something that hadn't really occurred to me all that much. And, you know, he said, what kind of music does he like? And I said, I think my guess is that Sully's the kind of man who wouldn't stay on any station very long. He would get it tuned in, and then he would find another station to listen to. And he would be all over the dial, and he probably would never listen to one song or anything, you know, from start to finish before. He would be on the radio kind of like he is in life, just darting, careening from one thing to another, always in search of something that will satisfy him and never having it there. And we had lots of conversations like that. He was constantly asking me questions about Sully that I had no idea how to answer. He wanted to know much more about his past. And ultimately, it was fun to watch him work this way, because ultimately, of course, none of this was going to be in the movie in any conventional way. It wasn't like there was going to be a new scene written to investigate any of this stuff. He just wanted to know more so that it might have manifested itself for him in just some little, you know, tick and inflection of the voice, anything that would help him know this man to the depths of his soul. Interestingly, we have since worked on another project together. Robert Benton and I, the director of Nobody's Fool, got to be good friends. We hit it off really right away. And as soon as Nobody's Fool finished, we wanted to work on another project together. So we wrote a screenplay together, which has just finished filming and is screening now. And Paul Newman is again has the lead in the film. And we kind of went through the same thing again. This character's name is Harry Ross, and once again, right before they started shooting, I went out to L.A. for a couple of days and spent time talking about all these things I didn't know about Harry Ross, so that Paul could dig deep into this guy's character. It was even tougher this time because there wasn't a big novel to go back to. There was just, you know, 120-page screenplay.
Paul Newman sounds like a total professional.
Yeah.
Richard Russo is my guest, and his new book is Straight Man. Richard, seems that some books get turned into films and the authors are really unhappy with the mm-hmm. way the films came out. On the other hand, you have writers who are thrilled by mm-hmm. the way the films came out. Mm-hmm. Pat Conroy was here a couple years mm-hmm. ago. He seems very happy with the films. And then you have mm-hmm. guys like Robert Kraes who won't even allow his books to be made into films because he doesn't want the thoughts that he created stolen and turned into something else. Mm-hmm. How do you feel? You're getting more and more into the Hollywood thing. Mm-hmm. Does it make a difference to you that people think of Nobody's Fool as a movie instead of a book?
I'm happy for all the readers that it's gotten me that I wouldn't have had otherwise, and a substantial number of those readers come up to me and say, you know, I loved Nobody's Fool. I thought that the movie was really terrific, but it wasn't. I enjoyed the book even more because there was so much more in the novel, so much that the movie couldn't do. And you know, my own feeling is that books and movies are so really discrete as art forms I always say to people, and I really believe it to be true, is that you can make a bad movie, but you can't ruin the book. I mean, the book still exists. It's out there. The fact that a movie was made of Nobody's Fool, they made that movie of Nobody's Fool without changing a word of the book. The book is still there. It's still intact. And people can go to it. And most people who love books, as I do, much more than movies, and I love movies, I think books are ultimately a higher art form. I think Robert Benton would probably agree with me if he were here. I don't think he would take issue with that, although he makes movies. He's in that other art form. But he loves books too. My own feeling is that obviously there are good books and bad books. There are good movies and bad movies. And if you're an artist working within either of those forms, you want to write the best book you can, make the best movie you can. Despite the fact that I love movies, and despite the fact that most of America seems more tuned to movies than to books, my own feeling is that great books change your life and great movies don't. They're just too passive. Doesn't require an awful lot of effort or intelligence, to sit in a movie. Chances are, in a movie that's beyond someone's intellectual capabilities, you're probably just going to fall asleep or be bored or something like that. But a good reader is active. I mean, you are in a kind of in order to get what's in a great book out and into I'm not being very articulate here, but it's a very active process. You take something away. It's not just you can't read Crime and Punishment in 2 hours. You can see the best movie ever made in 2 hours or 2.5 hours, and you don't have to work the way you have to work with a great book. And consequently, I don't think, at least I have never had a movie change my life the way books change my life. I think that the two things are so separate, are so different, and ultimately unequal, that it doesn't really bother me at all that somebody's going to come along and, I'm sure, make a bad movie of one of my novels. And the only thing I can say is, I'm sorry if you do it, but it's not going to bother me. Mm-hmm. It's not going to trouble me at all.
You have certain ways of saying things where I just stop and I read the sentence over and over and over and just say, that is so true, or that is mm-hmm. so funny. I stop dead in my tracks. I really do. And that's just an exquisite craftsmanship there. How long does it take you to write a page?
Well, that's kind of a hard question to answer. I mean, some pages don't take an enormous amount of time. Some pages take forever. I mean, the novel itself, most of my novels have taken anywhere from 3 to 5 years to write. I was teaching during that time, most of it. So, I mean, it wasn't like I was writing 8 hours a day or anything like that. But it takes me 3 to 4 years to write. And most of the sentences get turned around and around and around. You just keep after them until, like any craftsman works on anything, until you get to that point where you think, well, somebody might be able to make this better, but I can't. You know, it's writing, it's a cliche, but writing is revision. And the most fun part of a book for me is the early drafts, where you're really discovering content things. You're discovering things about your character that you didn't know. And every day is a revelation. Every day is really exciting. I write books the same way that I read them, in order to find out what'll happen. And the early drafts are wonderful like that. And I'm the kind of writer who doesn't worry an awful lot about what the sentences sound like when I'm in that stage of the process. Later on, though, you're not going to be much of a writer if you're unable to do the stuff in the 15th and 16th draft of certain pages of certain scenes. There is a certain joy that I would never be able to explain to anybody, of getting a sentence perfect, of finding exactly the right word, but also finding the right structure, the right rhythm, so that if you were to read it aloud, it would sound something like poetry. There would be a joy, there would be a deep satisfaction to just the sound, just the pure, unadulterated beauty of language, the joy of it. It's wonderful, and it's a different kind of joy from the earlier kinds of pleasures that come from just learning the story.
Well, Richard, we're honored that you could come by and visit us.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's been a fun conversation. I enjoyed it.
Do you have any parting words of wisdom for our listeners, Richard?
A duck a day until our demands are met.
You'll have to read the book to get that one.
Okay.
And this has been The Best of the Book Nook. That was Richard Russo, recorded back in 1997 for his novel Straight Man. The only interview I have ever had with Richard Russo, and he's quite a well-known novelist, and it was a pleasure to meet him in person. He was on book tour at the time, and he stopped out to see us that day on July 24th, 1997. I've run into him one other time at a convention, and I said, "Hi, Richard." I said, "How you doing?" And I reminded him about the interview, and of course, he had no memory of it whatsoever, but you do a million interviews, how you expect to remember all the interviewers? I certainly would not remember. In fact, a lot of times I go through my Book Nook archive and I see the name on a tape and I say, I don't know who this person is. And I spend an hour with them sometime, once upon a time, talking about their books. So, easily forgiven. You've been listening to The Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. Thanks for tuning in.